Welcome to the Diecast, everyone. I'm Seamus, and with me this week is Joshua.
Somehow, I'm still the last person called.
And that is indeed it. That's everyone, me and Josh.
Nobody else showed up. Campster is on, like, some fucking luxury cruise or something? Yep. Who knows?
And Mumbles called in this morning. She's like, I'm feeling sick. I can't make it to work. Fake sick voice. So she,
I think she is actually sick though.
She is actually sick. She was complaining about it a couple days ago on Twitter. It was kind of funny because she got sick exactly a year ago, and she had one of those retro tweets that reminds you, here's what you said a year ago. And she was like, oh, here's me complaining about getting sick exactly a year ago. And so that was kind of funny. So she is actually sick, even though I'm making fun of her. But I know she didn't want to be here because she doesn't want it. She is not down for this KOTOR when we play KOTOR later tonight.
If we do that, maybe that'll happen. Who knows?
Maybe. I actually doubt it. And having said that, no, we don't want to finish up KOTOR with just the two of us. And Rutskarn.
I mean, we could draw it out and do dumb shit, I guess. And then I could edit that.
Yeah.
And could,
yeah. Like, watch the why episode, change now?
We've lost so many viewers for the end of this season.
And then the Rutskarn couldn't be here because like it's a school night.
Episode. Yeah. We actually don't know what happened to Rutskarn. We assume he's busy doing something silly like LARPing, but
yeah,
who knows?
So it's just Josh and I. So now that we've blown the first 2 minutes of the show talking about how we're the only ones here, boy, is this a thrilling episode or what?
Oh, yeah.
Let's actually talk about video games. And let's start with... Actually, before we talk about video games, let's talk about what we're reading, because you and I are both reading the same thing.
Yeah, this sort of came up that Seamus and I decided to both reread Lord of the Rings at the same time.
Yeah, and I got a Kindle, and I got a Kindle, and people are misunderstanding what I mean. I thought there was like only one kind of Kindle. I was like, yeah, let's get this. I love this, because I liked my wife's Kindle. And I'm like, but how do you carry this anywhere? It's really big. And everybody's like, I just stick it in my pocket. And I'm like, the screen on this is 7 inches. And, you know, then it's got like a couple inches of border around that. It's not going in any pocket. Maybe if I had cargo pants. So I have no idea how you take this with you anywhere, but I love the little thing. It's the first mobile device I've ever used that didn't make me completely insane within 30 seconds of picking it up.
You should see my phone then. It's a 4.7 inch screen, I think. It's really big.
Part of my problem with using phones is I used a flip phone up until like a couple years ago. So I basically missed the entire evolution of smartphones, right? I didn't touch one. So, you know, and they sort of introduced features gradually, I gather. Like there's swiping, there's dragging, there's where you hold something down and then that's the holding on something is like right clicking, and there's certain styles of icons that you come to learn and certain things
to zoom in and zoom out
and... yeah, and the pinching, all that sort of evolved over time, right? And I didn't do any, so I had to learn it all at once from programs that just assumed you already knew everything and already knew how to navigate them. And so it was always like, it was like somebody going from DOS era or never using a computer before and then suddenly sitting down in front of like Windows 10. And it's like right click on, and you're like, I don't know what that means. And it's like click and drag. And you're like, do what? Click on, do you want me to poke the screen? I don't, you know, we take it for granted, all this nomenclature, but it is not obvious to people. And so I have a really hard time using my phone. And I'm always angry at it.
Because you just want a phone. I type in the number and have an address book, and I'm calling people.
Yeah, well,
maybe texting.
Well, yeah, I never text, but you do want that, oh shit, I need to Google something right now and I'm not at home. So that once in a blue moon thing, that's why I carry a smartphone.
To give you an idea of how, like, bizarrely beyond that my phone is, my phone has a digitizer sensor in it and a Wacom stylus so I can draw on it.
That's cool.
So, like, versus the, like, occasional Google machine and phone call device, my phone is about as far away from that as you can get while still having that functionality.
To give you an example of the kind of stuff that, like, this is every time I try and use my phone. I, like, needed to set up something on my phone, and I needed to put my phone number into a website. And I was like, shit, what's my phone number? I never call it. I don't remember it. I'll just pick up my phone and look it up. And I found three different settings menus, and none of them told me, like, in totally different parts of the interface with totally different labels, and none of them told me what my own phone number was. And in my flip phone, I could get there with, like, four little clicks. I mean, it was just easy to get to. And in this smartphone, it was just torture. It was just, like, click and drag and then, wait, no. No, I didn't mean to go back. No, no, you scrolled past the thing. Oh, it's not there. Why is it not here? Why would it not be in this menu? And it was like that for 10 minutes. And then finally I gave up, got pissed off, and just went and got my wife's phone and, you know, like, looked myself up in her phone because I could not find my own phone number on my phone. And that's like every time I try and use my phone. But, okay, the whole point, like 5 minutes ago, I started making this point. I don't have that problem with the Kindle. Like, I take a guess at how things ought to work on the Kindle, and it works that way. I'm like, well, how? I need to do something, and this, I can't do what I want to do. Oh, the screen's rotating, and can I look here? Oh, there's the setting right where I expected it to be. And the Kindle is just, I love it. I just took to it right away. I didn't have to read anything. I wasn't constantly Googling, how do I turn off this annoying bullshit feature, and things like that. So I really like it. So I like my first mobile device here in 2016. Welcome to the future,
Amazon's shitness. Amazon's interface is really, really solid for just easily jumping into kind of stuff that you'd want to do on essentially a big ebook reader. Like, it's a stripped down Android operating system, and you can't do all the stuff that you can do on Android, and you're restricted to, like, the Amazon store, but, like, who the fuck cares, because you just want to read books on it.
Right, exactly. And so, yeah, and so now I'm rereading Lord of the Rings, and I'm loving it, because, you know, I can't have tiny print books. My eyes are too far gone. So I need normal print books, and normal print Lord of the Rings is heavy. And so it's like, I haven't read Lord of the Rings in a while, just because you get, like, uncomfortable after a while holding that heavy ass book in one position for a long time. Then the Kindle is, you know,
especially tiny, especially if you spring for, like, nice hardcover editions,
which I always,
like,
do.
I like hardcover way more than paperback.
Yeah, me too.
I think, like, most people,
especially of Lord of the Rings, I wouldn't want to buy some. I mean, if I'm buying Lord of the Rings, which I've done several times in my life, I want a gorgeous copy because I love the book that much. But this is wonderful. I've got all. I've got all three books in this one lightweight device. That, you know, it isn't like, oh, it keeps wanting to pull closed when you're at the beginning, and then you lose your page when you're in the middle. And it's just a super. It really is a superior way to read. And I really like it.
And I'm also not reading it in quite the traditional manner, because I decided to, rather than whip out my old shitty paperback version of Lord of the Rings, I decided to check it out on audiobook.
Oh, yeah. So let's talk about the book itself. So who performs this version that you're listening to?
This is... So there was an abridged version that was performed by Ian Holm and a couple of other people that I briefly considered getting. And I don't think it actually has anything to do with, like, Ian Holm being Bilbo Baggins, because I'm pretty sure it was, like, a radio dramatization from, like, the late 80s or early 90s. But, like, it was, like, heavily abridged. Like, the version I ended up going with is narrated by Rob Inglis,
And it's like 18 hours long, and the one with Ian Holm was like 7.
Yeah, that's some serious abridging. I wonder what wonder what they cut. Like, how do you get that much book? Because there's not, there's a lot you can cut. I mean, I know because I skip all the time when I read. I skip nearly all the songs and poetry. I only read like Bilbo's short little one paragraph rhymes, and like I love Gimli's chant that he does within Moria. I really love that one, and I'll read that one. But everything else, it's like somebody's like, and now I'm going to, you know, do a 4-page rhyme about this ancient, and I'm like, skip.
Yeah.
So you could cut all that.
I mean, I imagine they cut like the same sort of stuff that they cut in the movies. They probably cut Bombadil
and yep.
like the whole Barrowdown stuff. And
he's so easy to cut. The
Rivendell
only
stuff.
The only problem you'd have with cutting the Barrows, if you cut Bombadil, you have to also cut the Barrows because he comes back and saves.
Doesn't
them.
Make any sense with like, oh, right. This random dude showed up. Because
this guy sings
it
everything. Where the hell? But then the hobbits get the Barrow swords, and those get mentioned once in a while later in the book. And I guess you can just ignore that, just as one of the other myriad of things that just never gets explained in the book. But that might be sort of weird. Having this
incidentally is 18 hours for just Fellowship of the Ring, by the way. I just picked that one up.
Holy cow. 18.
It is fucking long book.
That's big. I
believe it's 18 hours. Let me double check here.
Wow. So 7 hours just for the abridged version.
I was wrong.
Okay.
19 hours, 7 minutes, 46 seconds.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, that makes sense. Actually, I don't have a very good metric. I don't have a very good conversion system in my head for converting pages of read stuff and figuring out, well, how long would it take to read this? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't have a very good conversion in my head, but I guess 19 hours, that doesn't seem unreasonable to me, but boy, that's a long time. That means all three books would probably approach 60 hours. Maybe like 50. Because Return of the King is mostly appendices. So it's sort of half a book.
I wonder if the appendices are in the Return of the King version.
Well, I'm sure they're not going to just sit there and read them. But So Return of the King might only be like, I don't know, 10 hours long. So the whole thing is probably like 50 hours. That's a lot of reading.
That doesn't bug me that much because I am not a fast reader. I don't read very fast even when I'm pushing myself, and I don't enjoy trying to read very fast. Like, I've tried a couple times to learn how to speed read, but every time I just feel like I'm losing too much information. I'm not comprehending it.
You're not enjoying it. Enough. It's like, oh, but I can get through this museum in 10 minutes. It's like, well, yeah.
Right.
It's like not the
I very much like
to
just sort of sit there and soak in what I'm reading. Sometimes I'll read a paragraph over again just because I'm like, I want to.
Yeah. I often stop and think about, especially if it's a new story to me, I'd lower the book and think for a few minutes about what the characters are doing and what their goals are. And like, what do I think this character is doing? And does it make sense? And am I understanding them properly? Did I miss something?
And I realize it's a different mechanism going on in your head when it's being dictated to you versus actually reading it on a page, but I
That's
still get the same
true.
Sort of thing out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So any comments on the book itself? I mean, I know this book is older than either of us, but
are you sure, Seamus?
Yeah.
I thought you were, sure. I mean, I don't know.
Tolkien was alive when I was born. So that's kind of his life, and my life barely overlapped.
He died in like 76?
Yep. Died when I was a little baby kid.
Yeah, so still at least 10 years before me. I forgot how, like,
weirdly disconnected the Tom Bombadil stuff is. And, like, I last read Lord of the Rings a solid, like, decade and a half ago, so I kind of, I don't remember that much about the books. By comparison, I watched the trilogy of Peter Jackson movies and the extended editions, like, 3 months ago, so I'm coming to it with that kind of in my head. And I remember when I watched the movies, I was disappointed that, oh, they cut out Tom Bombadil. That sucks. But, like, I got to it again now, and I'm like, wow, this just drags on and on and on and on, and this guy is just singing all the time, and it's terrible.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I've always said cutting Bombadil. I made jokes about it in Lord of the Rings, like I was mad about him, about Jackson leaving out Bombadil. But the truth is, it is completely a reasonable thing to do. To really do Bombadil justice would be like a half hour of screen time.
Yeah, and that would just be like you'd have all the audience sitting there going like, what the fuck is
and
going
on? And
you
think, oh wow, this guy's getting, you know, this guy's getting a big chunk of the movie. He must be important. Yeah. And then no.
And then he's not.
And then he sucks up more time at the Council of Elrond because Tolkien's introduced this massively superpowered, basically demigod.
Dude who is not at all affected by the ring, which is unique amongst named characters in Lord of the... I mean, I guess like the Ainur probably wouldn't be affected by the ring, which they're basically gods, but like everybody else...
Right, so Tolkien has introduced this super powerful character, so in the minds of the audience, they're like, well, why don't we have this guy solve this? So then you have to dedicate several pages of the Council of Elrond, which is already a pretty big... It's my favorite chapter of the book, but it is big. Yeah. It is big, and you've got
and
to burn
a
couple pages.
And it is
a
massive information dump.
It is.
What the hell do we do with this? Can we do this? No.
It's my
Can
favorite...
we do that? No.
Yeah, I like it because of that, because it's a bunch of people sitting around trying to figure out how they can solve this problem. But I totally get people who are like, boy, the story sure does come to a grinding halt for like 100 pages where nothing happens except people talk and tell stories and tell each other stuff that's already happened that we've already read. But
yeah.
So after introducing Bombadil, then he has to like dedicate even more of the book to then fixing the problem
has, like,
of
like,
yeah,
3 or 4 pages of just like this is why it wouldn't work, and also it's really weird that you found Bombadil. That's kind of weird and creepy, and like implies some weird stuff about Bombadil, but like.
Yeah.
Bombadil is such a weird character. It's literally for 4 chapters, like you fall into a different story entirely. A different kind of fairy tale.
It's world building. Tolkien had all this shit that he put in this world and he loved some. And I know what that feels like. You're like, you make up this fictional world and you come up with all these cool characters and you realize this one doesn't really have anything to do with the story, but they're so fun and I really want to write them. I'll just sneak them in. And then they grow and they grow.
Yeah.
And pretty soon.
And they almost become kind of a plot tumor.
Yeah. And you've got to be, but he took care of it. He dedicated Council of Elrond to like crossing his T's, dotting his I's, you know, making sure that you answer all the reader's questions of why can't we do that? And I really, that's why I love it, is because it like, it focuses the entire story on this is why we have to do this incredibly difficult thing, even though it seems insane. And it's why the rest of the books work so well, is because it began with this focus.
That's one of the most interesting attributes of Tolkien, which is that he came to writing this story not from an idea of, like, I have an interesting plot idea or I have an interesting set of characters, but he wasn't a linguist. He was a philologist, which is a subtly different discipline than a linguist, but he was basically...
It's like a high-level linguist.
Evolution.
He was, like, level 20.
He studied...
It's a specific, like, he studied specifically the evolution of the English language.
It's a prestige class, really, of linguist.
and he came at writing his story from the perspective of, I'm going to figure out languages for this world, then I'm going to figure out the world, then I'm going to write the story. Which sounds really backwards to most writing techniques where you start out with, oh, I have this idea for a character, or I have this idea for a plot, or maybe even just like a particular scene, and you go from there. Tolkien kind of came at it from, I'm going to build up this world, and then I'm going to do stuff in it. Like, to the extent that, like, The Hobbit wasn't even originally part of his greater mythology. He sort of stepped backwards into incorporating it. And the ring originally was nothing more than a ring of invisibility, and the Lord of the Rings had to take a lot of steps to fix that and turn it into, oh, by the way, this is actually the super weapon of the enemy. And that's a really interesting way to write a story, and it really comes through in that he spends an absolutely absurd amount of time and words explaining and digressing into the world building of his world, to the extent that you can really very easily tell that he was one of those writers that knew way more about the world than he let on. Whereas with a lot of writers, you kind of get this sense of, like, the world exists solely to serve the plot. The setting is a function of the plot.
You ask, hey, what's this guy do for, we run into this one, what's he do for a living? And the writer would be like, I have no idea. I just put a guy in there because we needed somebody to explain which way to go. And if you ask Tolkien that, he'll go, oh, well, what does he do for a living? Well, first let me get out his family tree that I made for him. And you'll see that he comes from a long line of carpenters. Now you see here, this side of his family spoke this language and this side of the, and you're like, oh, I'm so sorry I asked this question.
And that kind of gets back into, like, that's all really cool, but it's also kind of the reason why I don't actually like reading his prose very much, because it's so digressive and so glacially paced in places and goes into, like, weird sort of stuff that no editor would allow him to keep in a book, like Tom Bombadil.
It is a book that is sort of a director's cut of itself. Like, that makes it a good book for rereading. Once you know the story and you're not in a hurry to see how it all turns out, you can, like, read through it and come to appreciate the extra richness and detail. But that first push, my first push through Lord of the Rings, I found it slow. I found it.
Yeah, and you're.
I got impatient.
You're going, like, holy shit, I'm on the fifth page of this song. When is this going to end so we can get back to the stuff that's going on in this world?
There's important shit. There are orcs chasing us right now, and they're coming to kill us. A couple of us are injured, and we're in this place of danger, and Gandalf is dead, and nobody knows what's going on, and you're going to stop and sing for 3 pages? Oh, are you crazy?
Spoilers, dude. I really respect Tolkien for his ability to build worlds and his attention to detail, and the fact that he fucking invented several unique languages for this world that are fully functional languages that you can go and learn. I just, like, he's not that great of a novelist, in my opinion, in the way I see him.
You know, if you're looking for a good yarn, then... No, he's probably not your go-to guy. It's a very slow yarn then. If you want meticulous world building, he's your guy. And the more I think about it, if you're doing something, medieval Europe land like that, the more I think about it, the more I think, you know, it is sort of annoying how everybody speaks quote unquote common in all these, like, overcoming language differences was a big part of everyday life. Like, nobody's, and there are like 10 names for every place and every concept and languages blending together and concepts coming, and it comes up in conversation all the time. And most stories are like, yeah, 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 everybody speaks common. Just let's not even go there. It's too confusing. And that's fine. That's fine if you just want to have an adventure story where the good guys beat the bad guys. But if you're like trying to set up this big world, then you almost need that foundation of like, why is everything called this? You know, yeah. Different places have different names, and those names are shaped by the cultures, and those cultures are shaped by the languages and the people that live there. And it's sort of all interconnects. You can't just take one country out of planet Earth and just look at it in isolation, because it's connected to everything else.
And it's actually an interesting thing you touched on with cultures and languages, because I've been really interested in study of ancient history, and there's a lot of trying to
speaking
trace,
of
like,
overlong
cultures.
Backstories.
There's a lot of in ancient history trying to trace the evolution of cultures and ethnicities, for lack of a better term, and in many cases, really the only way we can determine the difference between an ethnicity. Again, in air quotes, is certainly not something that the way that like people in the time living in the time would necessarily have thought of each other. It's a sort of more recent construct. But there's been a lot of attempts to try to trace the evolution of cultures, and really often the only link you have to whether or not a particular culture exists in a particular place at a particular time is what language is being spoken.
Like I was saying, like language is such a big part of everything, and we sort of take it for granted, and we just want to simplify it, and it's like underneath everything. But go ahead.
I've long been interested by Mesopotamian history and mythology, and some of the people who most likely probably invented the very first written language, the Sumerians. We know some things about the Sumerians that we only really know because of their language. We know, one, that they weren't originally native to Mesopotamia. They came in from somewhere else. We don't know where else, because, two, Sumerian is actually a language isolate. That means we have no known link to any other language family. It's not Indo-European. It's not Semitic, it's something else. We don't know where they came from, but we know they weren't originally there, because some of the earliest cities in Sumer, in ancient Mesopotamia, have Semitic names. So the working theory is the Sumerians migrated in from somewhere else. We have no idea where, because we have no idea where their language descended from. We have no other languages to compare it to that seem to be related in any fashion. They moved in, displaced or intermingled with the local Semitic population, but kept their non-Semitic language, and developed some of the very first civilization stuff, the very first written language, one of the most complex early economies, that sort of thing. And we know all of this only because of our ability to trace the Sumerian language, and we only know that because of our ability to read it. And it's really interesting to think about that as that's the only real reason we can even distinguish this Sumerian ethnicity or group of people or culture from anyone else in the region is because of their language.
Yeah.
So I think it's a really interesting way to go about developing a world. I wish I could do that, but I'm not a linguist, and that's kind of the problem, is that, like, you need a particular background to even attempt to approach
that. Exactly. I ran into this when I did my the D&D campaign I have posted to my site, which is the reason my blog exists today, is that was the first thing I ran into. Well, what am I going to call this stuff? And it was like, well, I originally gave it sort of England-ish names, where you just name things whatever English speakers, you know, common speakers. Okay, peasants are like bad at naming shit. They'll just call a river Loudwater. Like, okay, that's Loudwater because it's, you know, flows it's really noisy water and it's near us. And so it's loud and we'll just call it loud water. And then, and we'll call this, you know, Great Big Hill. And then, you know, language gets muddled later and those words no longer mean that, but it's still called that phonetically. And so you look at a map and it's like all these descriptive names that no longer fit or quite make sense. That's how I originally made my map. And I was unhappy with that. And the players poked fun at it. And it felt like a little too pedestrian. And I wanted them to go someplace exotic. And so eventually I punted. I just like typed the name of whatever this is. This is Big Mountain. So I'll type Big Mountain into Google Translate and select Norwegian. Or whatever produces something that looks... I can't remember what it was. If it was Norwegian or not. But it was one of those languages up there that just produces something that looks like it's... looks like English, you know? As in, it has...
Right.
It doesn't have a bunch of letters that we don't have. It uses our alphabet, put it that way. And that's how I named everything in my campaign. But the whole time I was like, you know, this would be easier if I had better tools. Like, things get named different things and names change. And I felt like I wasn't building a good enough foundation. And I totally admit I was doing this for my own gratification. I didn't need this to write the campaign, but it was something I felt like I needed to do. Like, I felt like I was half-assing it if I didn't do it.
And also, if you can develop enough of a structure there behind the narrative of this particular way this language works, then you can use it to synthesize new names on the fly and new histories and potentially interesting stuff.
Yes, exactly. Once you have that tool, you can just continue to fill things in all over the place.
I always feel like whenever I'm doing a new story idea with a new setting, I'm grossly inadequate in the naming things sort of category, in the developing a language.
I had a project that just fell apart on me. I had this idea of, like, you know how you always have in fantasy fiction, and I'm sure somebody else has done this, but I've never read it, so, you know, I'm coming at it from... to me, this is a novel idea. You've always got those sort of local gods. That idea of, like, well, he's the god of the forest, and this person is the god of such and such a region, or this is a god of this particular sect of religion. Like, what if you took one of those gods and told the story from their perspective about all these crazy humans that move in and hold all these wars, and, like, what would, like, these humans just come and go. They're like, to this god, they would be like, they'd be like goldfish. I mean, they're just like, oh, some more born, some more die.
Or an ant colony or something.
Exactly. Like, they just come and go all the time. But what would motivate you if you're god of this region? What would motivate you to, like, interact with them and talk to some of them and, you know, give somebody a magic sword or bless them or be angry at them? And what would limit, what would just, like, limit your power? How would that work? Like, okay, I guess taking all those bullshit random gods that are made entirely of contrivances and trying to come up with a system of rules that would make their behavior make sense. Like, oh, you're super powerful, but you, why did you make me hike up this mountain to get this thing instead of just giving it to me when apparently you can just do that? Why would you do that?
That really bugs me about generic fantasy settings.
Yeah. Yeah, and so this was a way of, like, trying to build a god that operated. And so so the people of the story would, in fact, be annoyed with this god that sometimes he doesn't seem to exist, and sometimes he does, and he doesn't always do what they want. But from the god's perspective and from the reader's, it would make total sense. Because you could understand this character. And the first thing I ran into was this world building thing. Well, I need to have, like, different factions fighting. I mean, you don't just want, like, one city there. You want a couple of cultures to slam into each other to give this character. And I was like, but I have no idea how to create that. I have no idea how to make something like that believable and work and span and, you know, follow a story that might span 1,000 years. And I eventually gave up on it. I'm like, I don't know how to do this.
Which I think is why a lot of people just base things off of, like, loosely off of either prior history or prior mythology. Unfortunately, in the case of the fantasy genre, they usually just base it off of Tolkien without really understanding Tolkien's own deep linguistical and cultural understanding of what he was writing.
And they just crib stuff from him, and yeah.
Yeah, and you get stuff like the Forgotten Realms D&D setting, and super generic polytheistic gods.
and that's almost the reason I wanted to write this story, is because those gods are so annoying. They make no sense. You know, because they're all over the place, because they have 1,000 authors.
Not to lean on Mesopotamian mythology too heavily here in this conversation, but I find it a lot easier to explain gods like that if they're like the Mesopotamian pantheon, where they fucking don't care. They don't like humans all that much. Like, I literally, the exact reason named in the Sumerian version of the flood myth for why Enlil, the not quite the chief deity, but the dude who decides to send the flood to wipe out all humanity, the reason he decides to do this is, and I am not exaggerating here in any fashion whatsoever, is because the humans were just making too much damn noise. They just kept wailing and crying about their failed crops, or someone died or whatever, and Enlil was just like, fuck it, kill them all. That is literally what happens.
All right. I feel it is time to move on. You know, as much as I talk about Lord of the Rings, kind of permeates my site, and I think that's the first time we've ever discussed it on the diecast. Moving on, let's talk about Firewatch.
Yeah, so that came out, and everybody's playing it. I was surprised by how many people on the spoiler warning cast, that also happened to not be here right now, actually, like, ended up playing it right as it came out.
I think we've all played it, right? I think everybody on the cast has played
everybody it. Everybody has definitely played it and finished it, except Rutskarn at this point, I think. I don't know about Rutskarn. He might have done it, but...
I loved it.
I played it and finished it in one session right as it came out.
Yeah, I did. I think that's the way to play this game. I think it works best. I mean, it was like two sessions. I like played through the first half, and then I took an hour break and came back and finished it off. So, but it was, you know, one evening. And I think that's the way to play this game. I don't think this game would benefit from being twice as long. I think it was exactly the right length.
No, I'm maybe a little bit more at the end. Filled it out a bit better, but that gets into my criticisms. But like, yeah, it's 4 to 5 hours long. I think I have a little over 5 hours on it, and I was kind of obsessively investigating everything.
Yeah, I spent about 4 hours with it, and I was a little in a hurry to find out what happens next, and I knew there was like little things that I wasn't checking out and doing. So that makes sense. It's 4 hours for the core story, and then another hour of dicking around, if you're curious.
And before we really go any farther here, it is impossible to talk about this game in any capacity whatsoever, aside from it exists, without spoiling basically everything in the game.
Yeah.
So if you want to play Firewatch, jump to the next timestamp in the show notes and listen to whatever we have to say after we finish this segment, because this is going to be spoiler heavy.
Okay.
So you loved it.
Vader is Luke's father.
Right.
So let's talk about this game.
Right. So you loved it. I didn't. And I'm not. Part of the reason I want to talk about this, because we were talking about like whether or not to talk about this, and we almost decided not to, because we weren't sure we would have that much to say, because there's only two of us, and I have kind of a meh opinion. But part of the reason I wanted to talk about this is because I don't fully understand why I got disconnected from it at some point. Because, like, up until, like, up in through the second act of the three acts of this game, I was really into it. Then the third act hit, and I kind of just went, I sort of retreated into this mindset of, well, this is happening. And it kind of lost the ability to affect me on an emotional level, and I'm still not really sure why that happened.
Although that would kill the game. I mean, there's no game, there's no difficulty, there's gameplay here, but it's mostly getting around gameplay and some extremely light puzzle solving.
It has gone home in a forest with some other person on the radio with you.
Yeah. It kept up the emotional connection with me, so I was good all the way through. My only complaint is I really wish they did like photographs in the game. They're drawings that an artist made, but they're supposed to be photographs of things because the game has a cartoony style. I thought the intro would have benefited from having some pictures to go along. It's all text. It's like, hey, you are in a bar, and here are two things you can do, and you just choose. It's like choose your own adventure, and it's only like 2 minutes long. It's like super short, but it establishes Henry's
back. It is a really interesting way to introduce the story and the characters.
So much better than an info dump, especially since you need to know Henry's story. You can't like backfill that in dialogue. In fact, the big choice is now that you know Henry and what he's been through, once you actually start playing the game, people ask you, so why are you here in the forest? Why'd you come out here? Why'd you leave civilization, basically? And you have to decide, do I want to tell Delilah about my wife being super sick and basically dying of Alzheimer's? She can't even recognize me. Do you want to be vulnerable like that, or do you want to keep it a secret? You know, is Henry interested in Delilah romantically? You have to make these calls. Because if you were interested in Delilah, then saying, yeah, my wife got Alzheimer's, so I ran off, is probably not a great way to impress Delilah. So there are some interesting choices to make there, but you can't make those choices unless you know what happened to Henry in the beginning in the text crawl. But I really wish they had just some postcards to go with that intro. It was like, you don't find out what Henry looks like. I thought it was weird because I had this picture of Henry in my mind, and without anything else to fill it in, I'd sort of filled it in with just generic. I can't remember what my original template was, but then the game starts and you're a burly guy who drives a pickup truck, and that didn't fit with the image I'd already built in my head. And you're a burly bearded guy who drives a pickup, and that was different from the Henry I'd constructed. So I was like, oh, I kind of have to go back and like, if they just had a couple pictures during that intro, it would have smoothed it right out and I would have been on the same page.
Yeah.
Right from the get-go, and that would have worked much better, and I wouldn't have felt like I needed a mental do-over of the picture I'd been picturing in my head.
Yeah, that definitely might have helped the intro. So you get to this. You're a fire watcher. You watch for fires. You're part of the park ranger service in some capacity, I guess. You sit up in a lookout and keep an eye on things. And as the game progresses, some creepy stuff starts to happen, and you start to get the inkling that somebody is watching you, who fire watches the fire watchers, insert joke here, and...
Yeah, you've got to figure out who's fire watching the fire watchers so you don't get fired. That's like literally what you've got to do.
So you don't go to jail for criminal negligence / arson. And I think the part where it lost me is it starts to commit to this like very X-Files-esque black helicopters government shit, and it commits to this plot line so heavily that the twist at the end, which I didn't really not see coming,
But like the like I kind of expected it wouldn't really be the Black Helicopters plot, but the twist at the end where it turns out it's just some random dude in the forest that's fucking with you is so unbelievable. It's actually less believable than the original paranoid delusion.
That clicked right into place for me. You knew Ned was out there. And of course he had a crush on Delilah, which is why he hated you and wanted to smash up your stuff. And he had a terrible secret that he didn't want to get out. So actually, I liked it because for me, it felt like, oh man, I've Black Helicopters, the government's doing weird shit out here in the wilderness. What's going on? And then you realize, oh, it actually, you get the feeling that Henry was just out there alone for too long and the solitude got to him and he went paranoid. And the game sort of right. took you in that journey with him. And no, there's not Black. It's not a terrible conspiracy. Yeah, of course it's something mundane. Of course it is. And I kind of felt totally silly for
that.
Yeah.
It's just like, it seemed like things were a little too controlled. Like why yeah. does he suddenly leave the keys to the cave out in an alarmed backpack 200 feet from your tower?
Yeah. Yeah,
which was
yeah,
not there before, because if it was there before, your thing would have detected it before that time. And why at the end does he just decide to, hey, I'm going to show you everything for no real reason, I guess.
Right, other than he just has a change of heart for no explained reason. Like, if he had had an explanation for his change of heart.
Yeah. And there were that kind of stuff, like, felt like... It almost felt like there was originally more stuff that was going to be in the game, and they cut some of it for the ending.
Yeah. But I liked it overall because emotionally it worked. I really did feel paranoid and like, what the hell is going on? And then you find out it's all Ned, and you're like, yeah, actually, that makes more sense than it being a crazy conspiracy. It's just somebody dicking with you. And so I went on that emotional journey with Henry, and yeah, it doesn't... Yeah. totally hold up in retrospect, but in the moment it worked for me.
Oh, and that was the other thing, the teens that disappear and are missing, and it turns out that they just went like they just stole someone's fucking tractor and went for a joyride or something.
Yeah, and it's like, wait, for 3 months?
They were gone for like a solid 2 months, maybe 3 months, like reported missing. That never,
yeah.
like I
that
was
one
like,
stuck
oh,
out
that,
at
that's
me.
How we're going to resolve this plot line is, oh, by the yeah. way, nothing happened. It looked like they'd been murdered by someone and carried off into the forest or eaten by a bear or something. But no, they just ran off and stayed in the woods for 3 months and then stole someone's tractor and got arrested, I guess.
And you know what? I'm a lot more tolerant of this sort of thing because the game is short. Like, if this was an 8-hour game and you spent yeah. 8 hours, like, what is the mystery and what's going on? And you get to the end and it was like this boring bullshit. You need more for that much time and investment. But this is the gaming equivalent of a short story, and it's okay for them to end a little weird. I wouldn't want to read a big mystery novel where it turns out, oh, everybody was wrong and there is no mystery, and actually this was much ado about nothing. In a full novel, that would piss you off that a novel wasted your time. But in a short story, that's like, oh, it's more about the character. So I'm much more tolerant of fridge logic in a short, quick game than in some big epic where I'm expected to like invest time and interest in it.
Right. And I think something that contributed to me feeling disconnected by the end was that like I really wanted it to commit to that Black Helicopters kind of X-Files plot.
I kind of did too after all that time. I kind of did after all that time. You wanted to find out there was something going on.
And I realized that was 100% the point of the game. Like, you're making more out of this than it really was. And in the end, it's just someone else who is running away from their problems. I get that works thematically, and I totally respect that. But, like...
Is doing that.
Gone Home did this, like, maybe it's a haunted house, maybe there's some weird supernatural... Oh, no, it's just
a normal house. And this game did like the, maybe there's a big conspiracy. Oh no, it's just some random fuck in the wood. And I wish like there would be a game like this that would commit to this more supernatural element. Like even Soma kind of failed on this level for me because I was expecting something way weirder at the end of Soma than what ended up being the case, where it was like, oh yeah, you actually are, spoilers for Soma, a robot with a brain scan of you from 100 years in the past, and that's really just what's happening. I was expecting it to be like some kind of weird dream sequence, the whole thing, like of fixing your head or something, something weird like that, because it seemed like it was setting that up. And then it didn't do anything with it. And it was just like, oh, what's really happening in front of you is what's really happening. And I want more games like Amnesia The Dark Descent, where the weird supernatural Cthulhu Lovecraftian shit is actually happening, or the weird conspiracy is actually real. And the only games that seem to be doing stuff like that are like big, dumb AAA shooters like Assassin's Creed and Tomb Raider, where it's a lot less interesting because they're also action movies and the protagonist is a superhero.
Yeah, that's very true.
So that was kind of disappointing to me. And then it lays on what really like is not a terribly uplifting ending, which again is a completely valid thematic choice. It just wasn't necessarily what I wanted to be experiencing at the time. It's definitely not a bad game, and it's not a bad story, and it's not a bad way to end the game. It just was like one of those like I'm kind of depressed about the way this is going kind of situations. And like the best, most positive outcome you can get out of that ending is Henry. I keep wanting to call him Brian for some reason. For some reason he seems like a Brian to me. Maybe it's because I read Hatchet when I was a kid. I don't know. Henry decides to stop running away from his problem and go and see his wife and care for his wife again, and to hell with her family, who are apparently assholes. And that's like about the most positive thing. But like, she's still dying of Alzheimer's. It's still going to suck for a long time, potentially. And Delilah is still running away. And I don't mind tragic stories and everything, but it's like you kind of wanted to see the characters get a nice happy ending out of it somehow. And I realize with that setup, it's difficult to come to a happy ending. So I kind of felt like
it was a happy ending, because then this might be entirely headcanon. I don't know if this is based on the emotions I felt when I played the game. I felt that Henry had realized there's no black helicopters. I thought my problems were serious, and now this stuff with my wife doesn't seem like I can go and deal with my wife after being on this adventure. It kind of gave me a perspective check, but maybe that's just for my particular run through. I deliberately did not flirt with Delilah and, chose to kind of stay true to Henry's wife. And I don't know if any of those choices mean anything or do anything, but at the end, it felt like that's the arc that he was, okay, I'm going back to my wife. I can deal with this now.
I got an arc out of Henry without ever telling her about Julia. I think that is a valid way to play it. I didn't do that, but
no, I didn't either. Yeah, I thought, oh man, if you want to have like the most I felt like I was making a choice between doing the right thing and doing the most interesting thing for the story. And that's a thing you run into all the time in video games, because, you know, in a story that you're reading, the character can always do the thing that can cause drama. But in a game, you are trying to do what makes sense to you, but at the same time, the writer needs you to create the drama. So you're at odds with yourself, because if the writer lets you do the things you want to do, then the story won't happen. Oh, I won't make this terrible decision, and that won't therefore I won't create the conflict that drives the story. So it's a fine balancing act that the game writer has to do there. But I chose to do the right thing, and it worked out anyway. I felt like I got a character arc out of Henry.
And maybe, and I would be like super happy with the game if this was the case. I'm not sure, but I would really have to play through it again. But maybe like it's just the series of dialogue choices I made created an ending that was a lot bleaker than yours before I even got to it.
Oh.
And like, because I didn't like overtly flirt with Delilah, but I wasn't like wholly unreceptive to it, and she was like really flirting with Henry the whole time. I think like maybe like at the end, I kind of wanted to like not necessarily make it a romantic relationship, but keep that relationship going. And she's just like, "No, I'm running away. Goodbye. We are never going to see
each
other."
You know, that is another tension in the story, because she it basically reveals at the end that she's just. She has a string of relationships. That's how she spends her summer. She finds some guy that she likes and she hooks up, and her ongoing boyfriend doesn't know about it. And she probably just does it to keep herself sane up here. She's the only person you know up there in the woods. So she's the only, so you want to stay as close to her as possible because you don't want to go crazy being alone, and because she's the source of all the drama in this story. But at the same time, she's interested in a romantic relationship, and I kind of felt like that wouldn't be right. Henry has a wife.
Right.
So you have this conflict where like, well, I don't want to shove her away too much, or I won't have anybody to talk to. But on the other hand, I don't actually, and so I kind of felt like, I should string her along. And then I realized, wait, that's a horrible thing to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And I loved that the story drew me in that much to where I was like tempted to string this person along and pretend I might be interested for romance just so they would keep me company. And then realized what a villainous thing that was. And that was really interesting.
And I think it does bring up an interesting moral dilemma there, where it's not... From a certain point of view, like, you can kind of get the idea of having a relationship with this person and not necessarily cheating on your wife, because she's barely, like, to an extent, she's not your wife anymore. She doesn't remember you. She's going to spend the next, you know, 10, 20, 30 years in this, like, horrifically scary state to think about, but she's not gonna like at some point do you move on, or do you stay faithful to this woman who may never even recognize you ever again?
And that is like a valid question. Like, some people would just say, well, of course, you put her in a home and you divorce her or whatever, you pay to have her taken care of, but she's not your wife anymore because her brain is literally not there anymore. She is dead, except her body isn't dead yet. And some people would have no problem with that. And that would make total sense to them. And there would be nothing immoral about that. And other people were like, no, you've got to stay with them till the very end. And I mean, it's not that, it's that they would feel obligated, that they would hate themselves if they didn't do that. And so, and that's an interest. This is something that people deal with now. They're like, ask, well, how much of an obligation? What do I need to do? What should I do? What will other people think? And it's not an easy problem to solve.
And I think the game was very nuanced with that, and I really respected it for that, where it wasn't overtly saying you are a scumbag for considering cheating on your wife.
I like that too.
It never really what it would be called.
It never jumped out with a gotcha. Gotcha, you bastard. How dare you flirt with somebody when you have a wife? It never did that. It didn't judge you. It just felt like it was letting the story play out.
Yeah. I thought the voice direction and acting was fantastic too, though.
Oh my goodness. Like, those are two of the best voice acted characters I've ever seen in a video game. And I think a lot of it is because they are all voice. There's no, imagine Delilah's lines coming out of a Bethesda face. How instantly that would ruin that awesome performance she gave. Delilah felt like women I've known in my life. That somebody who always is telling half bullshit. Like, everything she says is half bullshit. Not that she's trying to deceive, but just like she's got this really loose relationship with the truth. And that's how I've, and I felt like, oh wow, I've known women like Delilah. Well, I've known people like Delilah, but she really resonated with me as like a real person, and especially in her line delivery. It just really felt familiar and genuine and real. And I'm so glad that she was off in her tower and I never had to walk up and watch some putty-faced bunch of polygons try and speak those lines.
I think like at the end you can ask her to stay or tell her to leave before you show up, and regardless she leaves. And I think like it kind of would have ruined everything if you actually saw her in the game as a polygon model.
You know, I knew that was, they, like, I knew that
unless they brought in like tech for that one particular moment that was like equal to the Witcher 3 like level cinematic stuff.
Right.
It just wouldn't have worked.
I knew she would take off when she's, you know, you get this choice where you can tell her, no, leave, or you should stay, wait for me, I'll be there soon, or you should go. I immediately knew it didn't matter, and I knew it wouldn't matter when I picked up the headset, and she's like, hi, and she's all, like, nervous and apologetic, and I realized, oh, that's the delivery that, you know, was intended for somebody that asked her to stay, and she didn't, she's like, sorry, I didn't stay.
I asked her to stay, so that's both ways.
What I mean. And that delivery that she gave me.
Yeah, go, get out of here. Fucking run from the fucking fire that's consuming the whole area. Get out.
The delivery that she gives makes more sense for your choice than for mine. So when she gave that delivery, I was like, oh, this decision didn't matter.
Yeah.
Well, it mattered in the character sense that that Henry did it, but it didn't matter, like, you know, it didn't change. I didn't pass up an opportunity to meet her.
Interesting point of trivia. The voice actress is Sissy Jones for Delilah, who played Katya in The Walking Dead Season 1, Kenny's wife, and Chloe's mom in Life is Strange. And I didn't hear either of those characters in this
one. I definitely didn't hear that. Katya had a funny accent. I can't remember what it was.
She was German.
And that I never, like, that accent never tripped my, hey, that's a really sloppy accent. Yeah. That's not real. I mean, it was a very faint accent, but it sounded like, you know, somebody moved to America 15 years ago, and this is what's left of their accent. That's how it sounded to me. And so, yeah, that was entirely done by the performer. So she's good. Put her in more stuff.
And Chloe's mom, Joyce, The Walking Dead, Life is Strange. I don't know if you got to the point where you even met her, but she's got this sort of like homely Southern accent kind of thing going on because she runs a diner. I don't know if that was just like something she put on for it or just happened to be the case, but you know, she's sort of a stereotypical like diner owner. So yeah, Sissy Jones has some range.
Evidently.
But yeah, I actually feel a little bit better about the game now that I've talked about it with you. I don't think it was a bad game by any measure, mind you. It felt like I was getting disconnected by the end of the story.
Yeah. Well, I liked it.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, let's do some mailbags here. Dear Diecast, last year you raised some understandable doubts about Square Enix's plans for the release of Hitman, particularly because of the lack of available details. However, in mid-January, Square Enix published an article containing some details that might change your perspective. Basically, we were worried because, like I said in the article, I wrote a column about this, like, last year, where it was like, it was an episodic game that you had to buy up front for $60. And I said this was terrible, that they were putting it had all the risks of an episodic game with none of the benefits for you. It was like, if they run out of money or cancel the game, you're just out your $60. If they sell one episode and cancel it, there's no recourse. But, now they're offering just the base. Now it's behaving like a proper episodic game. $15 up front, $10 per episode. When it's done, it will be cheaper to buy the quote season. It's cheaper to buy the entire season than to buy it piecemeal, but you can do that. And the question is, do you have any new thoughts on this, or are you still concerned? Yours, Merzendi? I hope I pronounced that right, Merzendi.
I think it's super fucking weird. I think this is really weird to see AAA publishers doing this. And Square Enix seems to have gone kind of fucking nuts as far as third-party publishing goes in the past 2 years. I don't know what's going on with their management, but, like, what the hell?
The question, do you have any new thoughts on this, or are you still concerned? I'm no longer concerned about the price up front. That seems a pretty... That's standard now. That's how you do an episodic game, and I am okay with that.
Well, few episodic games launch at $60, but this is a AAA episodic game.
I'm not going to complain about that. I always think, games could be a little cheaper. I don't think AAA is worth, I don't think this AAA game is worth three awesome indie games. And I'm always like, PC games are like $50, but I don't want to haggle over price, because that's a totally different argument. I think they're doing the best you could expect Square Enix to do in regards to pricing. This makes sense. I don't think it's a ripoff anymore. I'm still concerned because it is Square Enix, and they are just, like you said, they're going nuts lately. They're a mess, and I don't even know what their problem is. all of their properties are in some sort of weird sort of flux, and it's
Final Fantasy 15 is like a complete reinvention of the Final Fantasy formula, which is weird. Their Final Fantasy VII, the remake, is going to be episodic too. That's fucking weird.
Yeah,
you're remaking a game as an episodic game. Wait, what?
They've got two things. They're doing this episodic stuff, and they're turning all their properties into movies. Thief and Hitman. The latest Hitman Absolution and the Tomb Raider games, all of them just way too much movie and not enough video game. Just even
in fairness,
worse than,
that is not a unique trend to Square Enix by any means whatsoever.
No, but I think they're the worst of a bad lot as far as, while they have a lot of cutscenes and they're really, really awful. Like, I would take any Michael Bay action movie over Hitman Absolution any day of the week, no questions asked. Hitman Absolution is offensive on many levels. Like, it doesn't work even as bombastic, like, grindhouse, B-movie, titillation, lowbrow entertainment. It doesn't even work as that. It's just shit. Absolution is awful. And they took that story and decided to make a movie of it, and it was that bad. So
that a movie of Absolution?
I don't think
either of us have seen it, but Rutskarn.
No. I mean the movie that was in the game. Oh. I mean the hour and a half of
you're not talking about the second Hitman Hollywood film release that was also really bad.
No, I'm talking about just the horrible movie that is about movie length, I think. I think if you strung all those cutscenes together, it would be about movie size. And it's awful. Yeah. I mean, it is, like I said during our Let's Play, it's U-Bowl level awfulness.
It's incomprehensible. We had one episode where we went from being, or one series of three episodes where we went from being underground in some super lab to fighting a Danny Trejo-hulk, a gigantic steroid-infused Danny Trejo, and killing him in full view of, like, 200 spectators, to fighting a bunch of bondage nuns in an hour long section of gameplay. That was how that story went down. That was that movie.
Yeah, it was just it was ran on dream logic or something. It was just so weird. So it was awful. And they have this problem where they're really selling the cutscenes really hard, but their cutscenes are really awful, but they're spending a lot of money on them anyway. They're giving us stuff we don't want or need, and they're spending a fortune to do it. And then at the same time, they're also experimenting with this episodic content. And it's really weird, and I would love to know the thinking in the company that's driving these decisions. I suspect the cutscenes come from a sunken cost fallacy of like, well, we spent a lot on this full performance capture stage. It probably cost millions of dollars. We got to get our money's worth, even if by doing so we're ruining the video games we're making.
And I'm sure there's a feeling that if you do a game that doesn't have a AAA game that doesn't have a cinematic enough experience, that it won't do as well. And that may actually be true. I don't know.
That may be, although they seem to be going above and beyond what you need to just satisfy, yeah, to just satisfy people's need.
I mean,
for
it's
a trailer.
Like if The Last of Us is video games as a movie done right, everything that Square Enix has done lately is video games as a movie done at least a little bit wrong, if not like absurdly bizarrely, yeah, like what the fuck were you thinking kind of wrong in the case of Hitman Absolution.
Yeah, so I'm still concerned about the new Hitman, but I no longer think it's a rip. I'm just concerned quality-wise because Square Enix doesn't seem to be making very effective creative decisions. And
I'm confused. I like
that's a good thing to say too. Confused is good. That makes sense.
Are they backing away from the ridiculously cutscene-heavy Hitman stuff? Because they talk about, like, mission hubs, and they've done a bunch of, like, marketing that's like, hey, this is going to be more like the other Hitman games. It's going to be more like Blood Money.
Yeah, I'm really curious what they're going to do.
That could be good. I'm reading the article that they talk about this on, and they are saying, like, oh, this is going to be part of an ongoing story, but, like, to what extent is that story going to be front and center in cutscene form, and to what extent is it going to evolve from gameplay and, like, weird shenanigans?
Or just the briefings. I mean, really, that's... The original Hitman had as much story as it needed, and I actually appreciated it for that.
Yeah.
The Hitman does not need a lot.
That's the worst part about Absolution, is echoing stuff that I said during the spoiler warning season. Is like I felt that their story idea, the egg that gave birth to the monstrosity, was not necessarily awful in conception. The idea of humanizing Agent 47, giving him like more than just I am a contract killer. Again, this is like stuff that they did in every single other game, but like trying to do a cinematic version of it could be interesting. But they didn't do that.
No, I'd be down with that too. I like the idea of like he has to go and tear apart the agency, but they didn't really do that either. He just shot some guy. It didn't even make sense.
Like the vast majority of the time, he wasn't even going after the agency at all. The agency was against the guy that he was going against, but like they also wanted to kill 47.
Yeah, it's just so nonsensical.
I don't even remember.
I wouldn't mind seeing like a sane person take a stab at that story. Like,
you wouldn't mind seeing Rutskarn take a stab at that story.
Like, Agent 47 has to go rogue, go solo. But I always thought he did work alone. Like, I never felt like he had a lot of support from this agency.
The agency was, like, up until that game, the agency always felt like this is, like, five dudes in a hotel room kind of
setup. Right, it was like a broker. It was like...
Not like James Bond, MI6, super spy kind of...
Right,
going on.
It was a contract broker that gave you your jobs, and their job was just to like collect the money and send you the jobs and handle the communications and the details because you didn't have the people skills to do that. And that made sense to me. And so making them a giant organization made no sense. But I would like the idea that the agency turns on you for some reason. And that you've got to like hunt them all down, and that, you know, they would be dangerous in their own way. And in doing so, the Hitman would kind of have to be torn down and rebuilt and like question why he's doing this or whatever. There, you can make a good story out of that. But, you know, like you said, they didn't.
Yeah. Again, I'm pretty sure this was actually exactly beat by beat the plot of Hitman 2, but I didn't play that game, so...
Yeah, I've played... I think I've said this before, that I've played the first third of a lot of the Hitman games, and then I played one of them all the way through. I played the good one. I think it's Blood Money or Contracts. I can't remember which, but it's one of the favorites. I played it all the
way through.
Blood
Money is generally the classic fan favorite. Yeah, I mean, the only Hitman game I've ever finished is Absolution, so I don't know what that says about me as a gamer.
I've played Blood Money and I've played Absolution.
Blood
Money
is way better, but it kind of peters out, I guess, by like a couple, like when you're about five missions in, you're like, okay, I've kind of seen what this game has to offer. I don't know. Is that a criticism of Hitman? I'm not sure. Maybe it's a criticism of my attention span.
All right. So that's what Square Enix is doing wrong. I'm sure once they hear this podcast, they will fix it and everything will be great again.
Yes, we are the most notable and quotable voices in gaming criticism today and for...
They hang on our every word, waiting for our pearls of wisdom. All right, I think that's enough, Diecast. I have talked enough about video games.
Chris.
Huh. You're an example to us all, Rutskarn.